This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The National Archives is more than just the nation's record keeper and protector of records. It is the steward of the American story that preserves the past to protect the future. The records it holds are the original sources of that story, documenting the collective history of our nation through the actions of individuals and institutions. Every day, the National Archives and Records Administration touches the lives of people all over the nation. From the visitors who come to see the Constitution to the government officials seeking assistance in managing the records of their agencies. Yet changes in the federal government, in our society, and in the nature of records themselves drive the National Archives to change the way it does business and how it addresses the needs of its users. How is the National Archives transforming the way it does business? What about its digitization strategy? And how can you become a citizen archivist? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, David Ferriero, Archivist of the United States. David, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Paul Cayatta. Paul, welcome.
Thanks very much. Good to see you, Michael.
So, David, whenever I have a conversation with a guest, I like to set some context, and that usually is around providing us with a brief overview of the history and evolving mission of the National Archives and Records Administration. When was it created, and how has its mission evolved to date?
It's kind of interesting that it took this country so long to create a National Archives. There had been discussions as early as the end of the Continental Congress. There was this wonderful conversation, Jeremiah Clark, the representative from New York, asking the question, what shall we do with the journals? Shall we burn them, lest they fall into the wrong hands? And they left the decision up to George Washington to decide what to do with them. And thank God George Washington said, I think we better keep them. So it wasn't until FDR, actually, the Roosevelt administration, that the country actually got serious about creating the National Archives. And he created the National Archives and the Presidential Library System at the same time. So 1935, our doors opened. So that was the beginning. I did a lot of, as I was getting ready for my confirmation hearing, read everything that the very first archivist of the United States wrote about what he was up against when he was actually creating the National Archives. Robert Connor, faculty member at Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, told wonderful stories about the state of the records stored in attics and basements all over the city. Lots of things lost to fire and theft. Wonderful story about the records of the White House used to be stored in the garage on the White House grounds. Fire in the garage. Rutherford B. Hayes out there on the lawn and the bucket brigade trying to put the fire out. And so stories like that about how the records were being treated. And, of course, you know, the British burned the town. So the fact that the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights were spirited out of town the night before the British burned, it's a miracle that the things we have survived. So our collection starts with those journals of the Continental Congress, the oaths of allegiance signed at Valley Forge by George Washington and his troops, all the way up to the tweets that are being created in the White House as we speak right now.
With such an expansive mission, Could you give us a sense operationally how the National Archives is organized, the size of its budget, the number of FTEs, and its sort of geographical footprint?
Sure. We are 44 facilities from Anchorage, Alaska to Atlanta, Georgia, a collection of about 12 billion pieces of paper at the moment, about 40 million photographs, miles and miles of film and video. Largest growing collection, of course, is electronic records, about 500 terabytes at the moment. We started collecting electronic records during the Reagan administration. So between the Reagan and Bush 41 administrations, we have about 2.5 million email messages. Clinton, White House, 20 million. George W. Bush, 210 million email messages. So that tells you, gives you a snapshot of where we're going with that. About 3,200 staff in those 44 facilities. Budget of about under $400 million.
I'd like to transition to your specific role. Could you tell us a little bit about the duties and responsibilities of the archivist of the U.S.?
Sure. These are the things that they didn't tell me during the interview. So it's kind of a set of evolving responsibilities as I it's been 3 years now that I've been on the job. And I did have an opportunity recently to meet with David Jacobson, who was the ambassador to Canada, who was working on appointments for the president, and he's the one who hired me. And so I have had a chance to let him know all the things that he didn't tell me. So we are responsible for the records of the country. So that means all the records of the executive branch, office, cabinet offices, departments, about 275 agencies, governed by a set of laws called the Federal Records Act. We're responsible for what's created in the White House under a different set of laws, Presidential Records Act. Courtesy storage for the records of Congress. Congress owns their own records, but we provide storage and retrieval servicing those records. The Supreme Court records are in our custody. Federal district court records, reason for the 44 facilities around the country, federal records primarily in those facilities. So there's the whole management of the creation of records, the scheduling of those records. On the federal side, on the agency side, each agency creates a record schedule that kind of describes the kind of records they're creating. They work with my staff to create those record schedules. The records schedules describe how long they stay in the agency and at what point the 2-3% that is of historic or legal value gets transferred to the National Archives. And that transfer process is one that's managed by my staff, the National Archives staff. So that's on the federal side. On the White House side, another group of staff working closely with the White House Office of Records Management to ensure that the records are being created, captured, and preserved so that at the end of the administration they get transferred to the National Archives. On the presidential side, also we're responsible for gifts to the president, so the artifacts. Another set group of staff responsible for ensuring that the gifts are recorded and taken care of so they can get transferred at the end of the administration also. At the end of an administration, actually during the inaugural ceremony, my staff is in the White House grabbing the records and transferring them to temporary storage for the next presidential library. So that's kind of the basic record-keeping piece of the job. And then there are some other responsibilities that come with the position. We have within the National Archives the Information Security Oversight Office, which is responsible for classified information, monitoring and working with the agencies around classification guides, how records are classified. And then just after I started, a new department within the National Archives, the Office of Government Information Services, which is the FOIA Ombudsman serving the American public for helping resolve problems that they're having with their FOIA requests. So that's an additional responsibility that the Archives has taken on. And then we have a small grant making wing of the National Archives, National Historic Preservation Records Commission, which gives grants to states and institutions to preserve, digitize, make available their records.
So, David, as archivist of the United States, what are your top three, say, three challenges you face in your role, and how have you sought to address them?
Electronic records, electronic records, electronic records. It's clear to say that the biggest challenge, as you heard just from magnitude of what we're up against, is this transition from paper to electronic. And it's making the paper environment look really good.
Well, it's 12 billion, I think. Didn't you say it was something
it's
on
the 12
order?
Billion, that's right. And I scare my staff when I ask them, how do we know it's 12 billion? When was the last time we did an inventory? So it is clearly it's electronic records. It's ensuring that the agencies are creating, they're using the technology in a way that ensures that the records are going to be available 100 years from now, so that people can have the same opportunity to hold their government accountable, learn about the history of the country through the records. So ensuring that they're being created in the appropriate way and preserved, taken care of, and transferred to the National Archives at the appropriate time. So we have, just to give you an example, this is a huge complex issue, but just one little piece of it. Those record schedules that I talked about earlier specify how many years the records are kept in the agency. And for some agencies, it's 20 or 30 years that the records stay within the agency. And that works in a paper environment. It doesn't work in an electronic environment. It makes me really nervous to think about 30 years worth of electronic records sitting, you know, in outside of the National Archives. Changes in technology, just the ability to read those over time is a huge challenge. So we have created something called the Electronic Records Archive within the National Archives, which is the facility that ingests those 2 to 3% of the electronic records at the appropriate time. We're incredibly fortunate to have the attention of this administration around records management. The president in November issued a memorandum on records management, which authorized me and the director of OMB to issue a directive to the agencies, spelling out a certain set of requirements for each agency, especially around electronic records. So it's the first time since the Truman administration that a presidency and administration has gotten involved in records management. So it's a really exciting time for us, and I'm confident that we're gonna nail this one.
When discussing your role earlier, you alluded to some unanticipated or unexpected surprises. Since you've begun leading the organization, what's been the biggest surprise that you faced?
Well, there are pleasant surprises and then there are unpleasant surprises. So let me start with the pleasant ones. It's an extraordinary range of materials that we're responsible for. And I am daily surprised, shocked, in awe of what I see. You know from history that things happen. You don't associate documentation that proves that it actually happened. So you know we bought Alaska for $7.2 million, but do you know there's actually a check drawn on the Riggs Bank for $7.2 million made out to the Russians? And you flip it over, and there's the Russian endorsement, and you know, a wonderful letter from Annie Oakley to William McKinley, offering to raise a troop of 50 sharpshooter women who will supply their own rifles and ammunition to fight the Spanish-American War. You know, things like that you know, surprises on a daily basis. For me, coming in, some of the surprises had to do with there's a robust CIO, Chief Information Officer, community within the federal government, and a robust records management community within the federal government, but these two groups have never worked together. So sitting down with, at that point, Vivek Kundra in the White House and talking about ways that we can ensure that as agencies are creating new information systems, that the records managers are involved to think about the records implications of those new systems. So the collaboration across agencies, within agencies, and then across agencies, is something that we're working on. It was a surprise that that wasn't already in place. I guess, and in terms of the technology itself, it is very much the way universities were at one point in time, where every faculty, every department was able to go off and build their own system without any coordination across campus. And that's very much what was the situation when I arrived across federal government, that every agency had the authority to go off and build their own systems, and interoperability, the ability to exchange information, or, more importantly, to make the best use of resources in terms of working together to build systems, was not in place at that when I arrived.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, I'd like to learn a little bit more about yourself. Could you tell us about your career? I believe you are one of the first librarians to actually hold
the... I am the first librarian.
Yes. Yeah. And so could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I grew up in the libraries at MIT. I started shelving books in the humanities library there in 1965. I was a Northeastern University student. It was a co-op job. I was an education major at that point, and my co-op advisor thought that shelving books in the library was pretty close to education. So I fought with her for several months because I didn't think that that was going to be much fun. Finally, she won, and I took the job. And, you know, if I hadn't taken that job, I would not be sitting here talking to you today. And I have... my co-op advisor is still alive, and I've talked to her and thanked her for... for making sure that I took her advice. So I started at MIT in, you know, the very basic kind of situation. And the folks at MIT recognized the fact that they had someone who was curious and went out of their way to ensure that I had opportunities to grow. And the reason I spent 31 years there is testament to that. I dropped out. I hated the education program that I was in. I dropped out and joined the Navy. I spent 4 years in the Navy. I was a hospital corpsman. Spent a year in Vietnam. Came back. I head on straight, changed majors, and went back to MIT part-time while I was finishing my degree, and thought library school was something that I wanted to do. So did the formal program and stayed, as I said, at MIT, left there as acting director of libraries in 1996 and went to Duke University, where I was the university librarian, spent 8 years at Duke. Fantastic experience. The president of Duke saw the librarian very much as part of her senior administrative staff, so I got to be involved in lots of things that other university librarians don't get to participate in, like curriculum reform and campus master planning and creating a new academic technology empire within the university, so things like that. Great experience.
So, David, given your experience, what are some of the characteristics of an effective leader?
I am the third of four children. birth order really makes a difference. I spent my childhood, you know, bridging the younger and older siblings, trying to get people to work together, a skill that to this day is very important in terms of communication. That Navy career involved training as a psychiatric technician, so I worked with crazy people in the Navy and got terrific training which I use every day in terms of the listening skills, the empathy, paraphrasing, all those kinds of things, the communication across lines. I have a talent for identifying talent within organizations. My first, in all of my transitions, my first 6 months is getting to know the staff and identifying talent rather than bringing people with me. It's focused on my staff. I spent a lot of attention on the needs of the staff and listening to the staff and valuing the history of an organization. I spent 31 years at MIT, and one of the things that scared me the most about moving to Duke was how would I ever have this developed the same level of knowledge about where we came from, you know, our history in a new environment. But that's something that has always been important to me, is spend a lot of time talking to former employees, people who have been around for a long time, just to get a sense of where we have come from in order to move forward, and to take the best of those lessons from the past and celebrate them and move them forward into what the future, the planning for the future.
How is the National Archives and Records Administration transforming the way it does business? We will ask David Ferriero, archivist of the United States, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Ferriero, archivist of the United States and head of the National Archives and Records Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Paul Kayada. So, David, you had mentioned in our previous segment that you are the nation's record keeper of sorts, and you actually safeguard the records of all three branches of the federal government, and this mandate is unique. I'd like to explore your strategic vision that you've outlined to accomplish your mission. Would you tell us more about your strategic vision for the organization you lead and briefly highlight some of the key or the six goals that you have?
So the biggest challenge, as I said, has to do with our transition from paper to electronic records and the ability for us to ensure that we continue to provide the same level of service in an electronic environment that we have in paper. And our mandate is to collect, protect, and encourage the use of the records of the government so that people have the opportunity to primarily hold their government accountable, to learn from our past as we make decisions about the future. So that's broadly what the mission is. And the strategy in terms of doing that has to do with thinking about, and we're going through this process right now as a result of the new records management directive, rethinking the concept of record, exactly what is a record, what needs to be preserved, how it is preserved, and ensuring, as I've said, that it's going to be available in 100 years and more. And each one of those aspects has a separate set of strategies involved. The preservation piece of it, for instance, is huge, just because we barely understand preservation around paper. You know, that's something that we think we've got that nailed. Preserving electronic information is much more complicated. We've been experimenting with our early electronic records. There are lots of formats, obsolete formats, that need to be preserved. We have a tremendous number of NASA records in an old IBM programming system, EBCDIC language, EBCDIC. No one uses EBCDIC anymore. The ability to translate those into digits that can be migrated over time So we have a long list of things like that. Just think of the word processing systems that have disappeared. All of the email that I talked about earlier, you know, from the, back to the Reagan administration, the attachments to those need preservation, attention. So the electronic record system has created, working on, this preservation system which identifies, as the records are coming into the, being ingested, identifies the attachments and recognizes what needs to be translated. This is an international effort. This is not just the National Archives. This is, every National Archives is dealing with this kind of problem of ensuring that that electronic information is going to be around forever. So identifying, in terms of strategies, identifying logical partners to be working with internally and externally, and this is something that's new to the National Archives, identifying best practices within the government, within industry, within universities to help us solve this problem. Very much one of the things that attracted me to this position was this administration's open government directive. The president, on his very first day in office, in a meeting with his senior staff, made it clear and said that the government does not have all the answers. We need to find ways of engaging the American public and solving our problems. And I have really taken that to heart in terms of ensuring that as we're creating this electronic future, we are engaging those people in government, outside the government, who have the expertise in order to help us. That's new.
So you've discussed the principles that basically ground your records management approach and the involvement and interest of the president to participate in that. Along those lines, there is a presidential memorandum managing government records. To what end and to what extent are proper records management the backbone of the open government? And how does this records management directive carry the requirements forging a 21st century framework for managing records of the future?
First of all, I want to point out that backbone of open government is my words in the president's memorandum. That was huge. That's the reason we were able to capture the administration's attention. Because my argument is, if you're serious about open government, that means the only way you can have open government is if you have good records. And since the records process regulations are old, paper-based, it's important for us then to have the authority to move forward and basically revamp the entire record system. And that's what the memorandum did, authorize the creation of the directive, which spells out a set of requirements for every agency to work towards unified electronic records future. The very first thing it does is to require every agency to identify a senior officer responsible for records. So what it does is to bump up the importance within an agency of records management. Situation in lots of agencies is that it is not a full-time job. It's assigned to the most junior person in an agency, not very well trained, high turnover, so it's not, doesn't have a lot of priority. So the very first thing is to get a senior officer responsible for records. And I convened the first meeting of those senior officers and in December, and we, you know, kind of outlined the set of responsibilities that we need to chip through as we create this new electronic records environment. So there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done in terms of redefining the processes, looking at record retention schedules, identifying legislation that needs to be created or changed in order to accommodate the new technologies as we move ahead. But the fact that we've got the administration and OMB on board gives me great hope.
So, David, I'd like to transition to the transformation effort that you're leading. I believe you said you've been in the position of archivist for 3 years. And when you started the transformation effort. Could you tell us a little bit more about the goals of this effort, where you are now, and what lessons you've learned?
I inherited an agency. You know, as I said, we're 44 facilities spread out across the country. And the agency was basically organized around geography so that there was a fair amount of repetitive operation and stovepiping and across the agency. So we went through this planning exercise, this transformation process, went through a reorganization around business lines as opposed to geography to make better use of our resources. So consolidating all of our education activities. A huge part of our mission is educating the American public, especially the K-12 community, around the role of government, using the records to do that. And we have educators across the country before, not communicating, not working together, so not a consistent approach to education. So education, exhibition, same kind of issue. Records managers, so a different organization around function. At the same time, creating new units, opportunities to support the work that's going on. We've just created a new Center for Innovation that is going to, in October, we launched this new office, which is an opportunity for the staff to work on specific ideas that they have about improving the quality of services or processes, opportunity in our innovation hub that we're creating, opportunity for people from the outside to come in and work with us for 6 months on research projects, things that will improve access to government information, people from other agencies. So a new opportunity for the staff to be more involved in the work that they're doing. And that's the biggest thing in the transformation is opportunities for the staff to get more involved.
So making records available, accessible, discoverable online is critical for NARA. In fact, I think I've seen that NARA intends to make as many as 12 billion pieces of paper available to the world. To make that happen requires a very comprehensive digitization strategy. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how it fits in with previous strategies and what's occurring and changing through the years as you've developed this that potentially you've learned from?
So when I was at the New York Public Library, I was there for 5 years, and we were one of the original Google Book partners. So I was responsible for that project at the New York Public Library. We did about 1 million books with Google. So I got my feet wet in terms of mass digitization projects at the New York Public Library. Came here to the National Archives, and we have done a fair amount of digitization work with some commercial partners, which is a fairly common way for these large research institutions to get their content digitized. Our primary focus or our primary partners have been Ancestry.com, FamilySearch, those commercial partners who focus on the genealogy community, since that's one of our biggest. Genealogists and veterans are our two biggest user groups. So those commercial partnerships have been very important for us to get a fair amount of content digitized. We have done some on our own with our own resources. The National Archives will never have the resources necessary to do that 12. I'm the one who put a stake in the ground around the 12 billion pages. And it's based on my own experience and just my own reading of the tea leaves. This generation of young users, if it's not online, it doesn't exist. So instead of fighting that, let's make it happen. So let's be creative about ways to make that happen. So commercial partnerships is certainly something that I will continue to push on and explore. finding the resources, public-private partnerships to do digitization projects, another source. User-contributed content. We have a huge number of people who come in to the archives with their own scanners and leave with scanned content. So we're now in the process of creating opportunities for those researchers to share their scans with us as a way of building up this corpus of electronic information. And there's something on the horizon called the Digital Public Library of America, which is an initiative, public-private initiative, to create a portal to all the digitized content in the country. And it will come with resources for digitization projects. So there's another opportunity there.
Well, David, I'm thinking about the transformation efforts, the digitization efforts. I mean, there's a lot of things going on that you're leading. And I was wondering, are you feeling the pressure, like most agencies, around cost cutting and cost containment? Have you pursued any of those initiatives?
Every federal agency is carefully screening all expenditures, making plans for sequestration should that happen. So there's all kinds of exercises that are going on across government, including at the National Archives, to make plans for the what if. So what if the budget of the National Archives gets cut by $30 million? How do we accommodate that? And where does it come from? How do we ensure that we do the work that we need to do in a constrained environment? So it's an opportunity. In my 3 years, For me, it's the first opportunity to really look at how every dollar is spent, all of our contracts, everything.
How can the National Archives make records and history more accessible? We will ask David Ferriero, Archivist of the United States, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Ferriero, Archivist of the United States and head of the National Archives and Records Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Paul Kayada. David, in the previous segments, you've mentioned the Electronic Records Archives. I would like to know a little bit more about it, but particularly, how is it facilitating the preservation and access of electronic government records, and what are you doing to adapt the system to better usability?
So this is a technology project that I inherited 3 years ago, a project that had been underway for some time, planning in the late 90s. I actually signed a contract with a contractor in the early 2000s. And so a lot of thinking and development had gone into it. For me, the missing piece, and one that I think we're compensating for now, is the voice of the user. So this is a system that was built for the agencies, and we didn't get a whole lot of review participation by the agency. So we're compensating for that now. I have an advisory committee made up of folks from agencies and university and technology that has been reinvigorated in my 3 years. So we're getting some outside perspective on what we're building. And in fact, one of those members of that advisory committee has just been hired on as staff. So there's some spillover effect from that level of participation. So we have built a system that is not the best in the world, but it's getting there because of the fact that we have people testing and advising us, and we're adapting to the new needs. My biggest concern has to do with user access. Mm-hmm. We're early in the ingestion, so all of those records are not available yet for public access, but that's the next frontier to ensure that it's not good enough to ingest. We have to be able to get the stuff out of there. So that's the biggest push now.
The use of social media in the United States and the expectation that what you want to find, it needs to be a social media platform to find it, that's growing exponentially. Would you describe the current media landscape within the U.S. government and what the Archives is doing to work with other agencies in this area?
You're right. It is the next frontier. The use of social media is huge and growing. Every agency, every cabinet-level agency now has a Facebook page and at least one, and a Twitter account. And it's growing exponentially. Since we are responsible for providing guidance, we have provided guidance to the agencies and the White House on the records implication of their use of social media, ask a series of questions about, is this the kind of information that's being shared in these social media platforms? Is that record? And how are you planning to capture it? Part of the directive in terms of the work that we're doing in as a result of the directive has to do with social media capture. In terms of all the electronic information, this is the new frontier. Mm-hmm. This is actually the most exciting because it's different. The quality of the content is different than more formal communication. It's more immediate and much more, if you're serious about the voice of the people, much more interactive. And it's really exciting to think about 100 years from now for people to be able to see how the American public was engaging with their government in this new way.
So I believe you've been doing some experimentation in this area, such as the Citizen Archivists and the Citizen Archivist Dashboard initiatives. What else is being done in this area, or if you could describe those initiatives to help meeting what you've been referring to?
So if the National Archives is responsible for guiding the agencies and the White House on their uses of social media, that means it's kind of a no-brainer. That means the Archives has to be out there in front in terms of its use of those social media platforms in order to understand how they're being used. So I have encouraged my staff to every possible social media platform, get out there, experiment, and learn from your own experiences. So me personally, you know, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. I have a blog, so I'm out there myself. The Citizen Dashboard initiative is something I'm very proud of. And in fact, we just won the Administrative Council's Walter Gellman Innovation Award for Administrative Conference, of the United States, their Walter Gellman Innovation Award for the Citizen Archivist Dashboard. It is based on the president's message that we don't have all the answers. This is a way of engaging the American public and helping us do our work. So we have, this is an interesting factoid, lots of that 12 billion pages is in cursive. They don't teach cursive in school anymore. I think there are only 3 states that where cursive is still taught, K through 12. We have a generation of kids who can't read these records. So we are engaging the American public in transcribing records. We've got thousands of records up. You can go online and help us transcribe them. We have opportunities for you to tag photographs. We've got, as I said, 40 million photographs, not all the people identified in them. So we've got opportunities for people to help us catalog our photo collection. So there are 5 or 6 different opportunities for people to engage. One of the really exciting citizen archivist activities was a crowdsourcing effort around the 1940 census. In April, we released the 1940 census in electronic form, the first one in electronic form. and we didn't have the resources to do the name index. So unless you knew exactly the location that you were looking for, you couldn't be successful. We had 160,000 volunteers around the country working state by state to create the name index, which they did in 3 months. So an example of a citizen archivist at work.
Earlier, you described one of the roles that the archives has of being the stewards of classified information. Declassification performs a service crucial to a democratic society. When data is over 25 years old, you want to make it available to the public as soon as possible. What are some of the key challenges in this area, and how does the National Declassification Center work to address those challenges?
Let me start with one of the overarching problems, which that Information Security Oversight Office deals with, that I talked about. There are in operation now within the federal government more than 2,500 different classification guides. So it's not as if there's classified means classified across the government. There are 2,500 different kind of interpretations of that. So that's the one of the overriding factors. So we're now in this National Declassification Center, which was created by executive order at the end of 2009, reviewing 361 million pages of classified content going back to the World War I. And we have reviewed all 361 pages, so we know exactly what we have. And it's not as if this executive order gave the archivist of the United States the authority to release this material. It gave me the authority to convene the equity holders, those who classified them, to review for decision for release. Two criteria spelled out in the executive order by which it can remain classified: weapons of mass destruction, national security. Those are the only two criteria by which it can remain classified. So that means working with the agencies to review, and there's some very positive work that has been done to identify those records of an age that can quickly be reviewed. Some legislation that was passed in late 1990s, early 2000, the Kyle Lott, requires page-by-page review of a whole category of material, which has slowed us down there. But of the records that have been through complete processing, 61% of them have been released to the open shelves. So it's progress.
So, David, as part of your charge, you need to balance the need for access to archives holdings and make sure that they're secure. What are you doing to enhance information security, protect the integrity of the content, and ensure that there any restrictions on use are properly honored?
So one of the lessons learned in this long career of working in research institutions with valuable materials is never trust anyone. Establishing this balance between access and protection. And I've been through some horrible situations. The New York Public Library, a person who was a map dealer and very close to us, a member of the family basically, ended up stealing 72 maps from the New York Public Library and others, hundreds of maps from six other institutions. So, as I said, never trust anyone. Establishing mechanisms that sensitize the staff to paying attention to how material is being used, where it is, and creating formal processes for ensuring that material is not leaving facilities unauthorized. So, 3 years ago when I arrived, I discovered as I walked out of the building my first night that no one was checking my bags. Everywhere I've ever worked, my bags were inspected. We inspect users' bags, but we don't inspect staff bags. So instituting, just always paying attention to security, never assuming that you've got it right. We created a holdings protection team that has oversight now for those kinds of processes. We have within our Inspector General's office a wonderful archival recovery team that is surfing eBay, going to trade shows, looking for records that may have left the National Archives. So vigilance is the watchword on the part of the staff, but also engaging the user community about educating them, about paying attention to what the person at the next table is doing. And unfortunately, a large part of the problem is internal. You know, studies have shown that about 75% of theft is staff. So paying attention to those kinds of issues. We had a long-term staff member responsible for our film collection who turns out was actually stealing our film. So those kinds of situations really hurt.
So as we close this segment, I wanted to understand, how are you folks tackling the storage and space, the physical storage and space issue? How does technology such as cloud computing fit into that?
So for the paper records, we, as I said, we're in 44 facilities around the country. And we, I think, have been pretty clever out in Kansas and Illinois by using caves, wonderful limestone caves, which have been converted into storage facilities for records. So as we prepare for this transition to electronic records and the paper declines, the focus now, of course, is on storage for the electronic records. And we are now experimenting with the cloud. The cloud is the answer.
How does the National Archives cultivate civic literacy? We will ask David Ferriero, archivist of the United States, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is David Ferriero, archivist of the United States and head of the National Archives and Records Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Paul Kayada. So, David, the National Archives plays a unique and important role in promoting civic literacy in the U.S. Would you elaborate on your efforts? And specifically, how does the National Historical Publications Records Commission play in this effort?
So we do have a responsibility around providing access to the records of the country so that, as I said, people can hold their government accountable, but also can learn about how the government works. And we are taking this especially seriously now because civics seems to have disappeared in the curriculum, the K-12 curriculum. So kids aren't growing up with a basic knowledge of how their government works. So creating opportunities through our education programs across the country, doing a massive amount of work to create digital opportunities. We have something called Docs Teach, a digital facility that has thousands of primary sources, records, lesson plans that teachers have created and that we have created, and basically developing a community of teachers to share information about the use of the records in their in the classroom. The National Historic Preservation and Records Commission is a grant funding agency within the archives which supports the work being done in state archives and institutional archives around making those records that they have custody of available.